Well, good morning. Thank you very much, Mike and the Independent Institute. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here. And it's always a great pleasure for me to get out of the basement of the Pentagon and join you surface dwellers here, so I'm very glad to be here. I need to just highlight that nothing I say is in any official capacity. I'm a contractor with the government, so I couldn't possibly speak on behalf of the government, and I will not do so, of course. Mike asked me to talk a little bit about, for about 10 minutes, the growing importance of space. And one of the things that I think you will see throughout the four panelists is that even though we might disagree in many areas, I think all of us would really strongly concur with the fact that space is of growing importance, not only to the United States, but internationally as well. And it's not just state actors, but a variety of actors, to include individuals, are now empowered in ways that weren't possible just a few years ago. And that trend is accelerating, and we see no reason to expect that it wouldn't continue on. But in these short remarks, what I'll try and do is just concentrate on how space has become increasingly important for the United States military. Since I only have 10 minutes, that's what I'm going to focus on. I don't mean to imply that that's the only place where it's of growing importance, because, as I just said, that's not the case. But if I only have 10 minutes, that's where I'm going to focus. I'd like to take you back a little bit, and one of the things I really like about Mike's book is that he does a, I think, exceptional job of going through the history of what militaries do, what the U.S. military in particular does, what the U.S. Air Force did, say, in World War II. And back at that time, if you know, the Holy Grail was daylight high-altitude precision bombardment, and we devoted all kinds of energy into trying to make that a reality. But the fact of the matter was, in World War II, in the European theater, the average bomb did not fall within 5 miles of its intended target. That ain't too good. So that requires then different types of strategies. You're going to probably have to do area bombing, burning down cities, for example, instead of trying to take out a ball bearing factory or some such nonsense. So one of the things, again, that I like about Mike's book is that it places all that into context. So what's really happened, and I think largely as a result of space, is that that world has completely changed, at least for the United States and increasingly for another or a number of other actors around the world. Precision, long-range precision, is increasingly the case for modern militaries. And let's try and operationalize that a little bit. I'm sure many of you remember the 1991 Gulf War. That was touted by the then Air Force Chief of Staff, Merrill McPeak, as the first space war. Why did he say that? Well, he said it because space enabled almost all U.S. and coalition military operations during that war back in 1991. And things have only gotten much better in that respect since that time forward. Just to give you a few specifics on that, at that time in 1991, the U.S. Global Positioning System, our navigation and timing satellites, that was not a completed constellation. They only had a partial constellation up there. But even with that partial capability and really a great lack of receivers that were dedicated to being able to use that system, the U.S. and coalition forces were still able to travel and navigate in trackless desert, do rendezvous, have precision timing, and even to a small degree use that to guide some precision munitions. But again, at that time, we didn't have the entire infrastructure in place to be able to do all those things. Likewise, how did we know that any of Saddam's Scuds were being targeted anywhere? That was from space. Our defense support program satellites were the first ones to see the infrared signature of those missile launches, and we clues together a system that was able to provide warning, about 90-second warning, before those were going to come into theater. And that's another kind of example of how that system worked. The United States took an architecture that was designed to focus on the Soviet Union and strategic threats and started applying it down at the tactical level for much smaller and lower level threats. So obviously when you do that, you have some difficulties kind of embedded in that and morphing the system over into something that's more useful for that type of operation. And the total number of precision-guided munitions in the 1991 Gulf War was only about 7%. And again, those weren't guided by GPS. They were mostly electro-optical guided. But in that case, you have to say what its space provide, and it's the targeting coordinates for those systems, and then doing battle damage assessment to see if, in fact, you struck what it is that you were aiming at. One of the other things that a lot of commentators remarked about in the first Gulf War is that instead of having large strike packages go in with dozens or maybe hundreds of aircraft required to penetrate enemy airspace and achieve the desired effect, in a lot of cases, when you have stealth technology and the space-enabled technology, you can actually fly one plane in to do that same mission and have the same probability of achieving those effects. Let's move forward a little bit. In 1999, we had the NATO air campaign over Kosovo and Serbia. In this case, there was a pretty large increase in the amount of precision-guided munitions available and used by the NATO forces in this conflict, and predominantly by the United States. We saw the first use of the B-2 bomber in this operation, also the first use of the Joint Direct Attack Munition, which is a GPS-guided kit that fits onto conventional bombs. So those were all used to, I would say, pretty great effect. It was a rather long campaign, maybe longer than a lot of people wanted. It was about 70 days long. But at the end, Milosevic did comply with the demands of the NATO coalition, and there were no ground forces used in that war. So that's another kind of distinguishing effect. And finally, let me just briefly mention our latest unpleasantness in Iraq and Afghanistan. During those operations, we have almost a complete flip-flop between unguided and guided munitions. So whereas in 1991, only 7% of the munitions expended from air were from precision-guided kits, by 2003, the percentage was 70%. And that enables many, many different types of operations and smaller footprints, smaller numbers of people going into harm's way to accomplish those objectives. And also, I will just point out to you that even if you're on the receiving end of that, let's contrast that with what happened in Dresden, or even Grozny, for that matter. When you have the ability to precisely strike what it is that you're aiming at, then you're going to achieve a lot less collateral effects as well. So that could be very useful in that regard. Looking forward into the future, and I think one of the main topics that we're going to get into as a panel is, given that growth in the utility and use of space for the United States military, what would be the best path forward? And why shouldn't the United States at least consider trying to institutionalize or rationalize, maybe protect its capabilities when it comes to those space-enabled forces? And in my judgment, that is something the United States needs to look very carefully at. But as I'm sure we'll get into, there are a number of pretty difficult challenges associated with that. And I would just also highlight to you that there's been a number of efforts in this regard over time. The United States and the Soviet Union had three rounds of anti-satellite negotiations back in 1978 and 1979. And that achieved really nothing at all at the end of the day. The negotiators weren't even able to agree on what was a space weapon or other kind of key definitional issues. During the 1980s, part of the three baskets of strategic arms control included the defense and space talks. And of those three baskets, that was the only basket that didn't achieve an agreement. And in fact, there's really almost nothing you can point to in terms of a product out of that negotiating effort that went on for a number of years. So I highlight that to you because it's not the case that the United States and others haven't thought about this and haven't made at least some effort towards these ends. And certainly, I'm sure others will talk about the ongoing effort at the Conference on Disarmament. It's been, I think, since, what, 82, that they've been looking to have some type of prevention of an arms race, PEROS, either treaty or some other instrument that would help to maybe stabilize things in this regime. But I do want to highlight that that's a lot easier said than done. And I think maybe in the subsequent discussions we can get into why that might be the case. And I'll leave it here. Thank you. Okay.